So that's an interesting little point to our listeners out there. Listening to the show will make you smarter, better, faster in all aspects of life.
Welcome to the Point Forward Podcast.
Podcast episode number 9, more keyboards than you can type on. In this exciting episode, we're going to start out with some listener feedback, discuss first impressions of Duke Nukem Forever, and share some stories about the first time that we all discovered Alt-Tab. And we're also going to discuss more keyboards than you can afford, as well as
Sony is continuing PR debacle, Manchester encoding, Pro Boolean in 3DS Max, and ad hoc Wi-Fi. So, let's get the show started.
Podcast. Today is June 12th, and we have special guest Merrick with us again. Merrick, how you doing?
Pretty good. What's up, thanks Merrick? For having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming back. We have some listener feedback. Merrick, you want to take the first one?
I do. David B. sent us an email, and I checked with him, and we posted his email as comments on the Port Forward podcast website, if that is the actual URL.
Hey, which it is.
.com. I was testing everyone out there to make sure they knew what I was talking about. You all passed. He brought up a few good points regarding the last show when I talked about alternative keyboard layouts and, you know, the efficiencies or the what you might gain or lose learning one of these layouts. And his full comment will be posted, so you can check that. But one thing he mentioned was he included a few referenced articles too about some research that had been done or something like that. I clicked through a little bit and did not read it all, but he felt that he says, I think LNM's point was that the small advantage gained by persons who train only on Dvorak is eaten up by the inconvenience of not being able to use a PC without special software, and there is no advantage at all for those of us who must unlearn QWERTY if you subtract the time we waste unlearning from the time we save by typing slightly faster. So that's what David said. And when I first saw my friend with his Dvorak keyboard setup, I was blown away just because how different it looked. Like, he actually changed the keys, and I must have talked to him for about a half hour about it. And I was skeptical too at first, and I was like, well, wait, can you still type QWERTY? And he's like, yeah, I just, you know, sometimes I'll start typing Dvorak and then I hit, you know, backspace a few times, and it's muscle memory. So he's, my friend Bennett is trained up on both QWERTY and Dvorak at the same time, and he is faster than Dvorak. I don't have his exact numbers, but I'll try to get a hold of him, and maybe we could even have him as a guest one time on the show, or have him call in or something. But he is fully QWERTY and Dvorak enabled, and he's the one who opened, you know, my eyes to alternative layouts, and I first discussed it with. And based on not personal preferences, but just efficiency, you can be faster with a more efficient layout, just, you know, based on the fact your fingers have to move less distance to get to the most commonly used keys. And of course, this depends on what you type and, you know, how often you type, but that's my gut feeling is, if you want to be the fastest typist,
you're gonna get more hardcore to the next level, right?
Fully. Welcome to the next level. If you want to be there, you should learn an alternative layout. So it's definitely not for everyone. And David had some good points on that topic. And I'm not hardcore at Colmac yet, but I'm excited about learning it, and I will look forward to one day typing 150 words per minute. I'm not there yet, but we'll see. So thanks, David, for that comment. And the second part of his comment was about the scripting versus programming. And I also discussed scripting in Bash and how I'd recently taken a class. And there was times when I was aggravated because there's things that are different about the Bash language. And I guess a good way to sum it up is it's kind of a scripting language and not really a programming language. And it's funny because, Sam, I mentioned something to you before earlier how, you know, you're a hardcore, you know, pro scripter, but you don't really visualize yourself as a programmer. And when I first heard that, I'm like, wait a minute, but scripting is programming. And I was like thinking about that. And this comment kind of brought that back, David's comment, because he, here's a quote from him. As for your discussion of Bash, .. There's four dots there. An ellipsis, by the way, quick little grammatical point for all you people who are caring. An ellipsis, three dots, is the correct usage to have to indicate what he was going
to do. Are you correcting his email right now?
No, this is nothing against David. I only recently, within the past year or two, learned what an ellipsis was, and that's three dots after a sentence. And say, hey, now we know. To a guy, back to his comment, to a guy who has only ever used a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you hand the guy a screw, he will think it's a pretty crappy nail. And he was commenting on how I was complaining about Bash as a programming language. And it's probably me trying to visualize it that way that was generating some of, you know, the issues I was having was it's, I guess, not really a programming language. It's more of a scripting language. And that's the fact that you could sum it up into a category like that. It makes a lot of sense. And how, you know, if I assume David is, you know, a pretty hardcore scripter because he was defending his language, and it makes sense. It's, I looked at Bash, you know, with skeptic eyes because I was like, well, PHP can do this and this and this, you know, how come Bash can't? And, you know, there's a lot of different reasons, historical reasons, in fact. If you go back and look at, you know, the way Unix and Linux was born and all that, you know, everything happens for a reason. So.
Yeah, one of the things about Unix and Linux being born is the Unix paradigm. And he says here that the Unix paradigm involves piping output from one small program into another, using standard in and out and modifying it, filtering it or combining it as it goes. So one thing I'd like to say about that is specifically Xargs. Merrick, you and I were talking about that.
Yes.
And that's really useful. Like if you have a file that has a bunch of lines on it, let's say it even just has three lines, and you want to do something for each line in that file, right? You can use Xargs, and you basically cat out that file into Xargs, and then you could, like, you know, print out those lines, or you could search or replace on each one. Or if each line was a file name, you could then print those files in a row. So he does make a good point about how the paradigm works, and I thought I would mention that. So thank you very much.
Yeah, no, there is a power, you know, available to someone who learns scripting and, you know, how to do it well, and you can do amazing things with it. It's, you just kind of have to not view it as a programming language, and I think that's where some of my criticism was coming from, was I was looking at it, you know, from the wrong point of view. So it's good. David commented on that, so we could bring that back up, and I'm, you know, one day I might look back and be like, oh yeah, you know, I said that, but I'm glad he wrote in and said that, and it's good that we have this back and forth, because sometimes, and this is a disclaimer, not just on this topic, but on all topics, I'll read something or do something or type something or feel something, and then it kind of migrates into my brain as fact. And like, it's, I think maybe even a hereditary disorder, because my sister has it bad. Like, she'll just straight say some shit that you're like, what? And she's like, yeah, I know it for sure. I'm like, what?
Are you talking about Pathy X now?
Kayleen, yeah, Pathy X. This is her nickname for pathological exaggerator. That's her nickname, shortened down, Pathy X. And, she's awesome, but it's a hereditary disorder, I believe, and certain things in my brain will somehow get kind of globbed into fact, and then someone, I'll say something, and then I'll be like, wait, is that true, or do I just think that? And then, you know, so as a disclaimer to whenever you hear me say anything, go ahead and fact check that on the internet and get back to me if it's totally wrong.
So before we move on, just one last thing he says is, we were talking about return values, and he told us that return values were just for status. For instance, like, yeah, that worked, or no, you didn't work, or, you know, that program didn't work, or whatever. And what you can do with that is you just use standard in and standard out to put your data back and forth, which, you know, printing and reading in from the input, and then you just use the return values. So, I mean, that's kind of how it's different from a programming language a little bit. You just got to use different pipelines to get the data in and out. So I think we're ready for Merrick right here. I mean, I'm sorry, we're ready for Sam.
Yeah, real quick before I get into Neil's comment, Merrick, just going back to your thing about Colmack and Dvorak.
Yes.
Basically, you're saying there's no need to unlearn Colmack.
No, there's not, and they discourage that. If you get on Colmack.com, awesome website, that's, you know, where I read up on it, they talk about it's at your disadvantage to try to purely switch and move forward with your new layout. You want to stay trained up, because you have to assume there's going to be situations when you go to a computer that's QWERTY, obviously, and it actually only takes 30 seconds to download this alternative layout, maybe get it installed, a minute and a half, turn around, say if you are at someone else's computer and you don't like QWERTY anymore, but, they encourage you to learn, the new layout along with QWERTY, like, as in, you could practice Colmack or Dvorak by day and then go home and use QWERTY at your home computer. They suggest something like that. So you don't need to unlearn QWERTY. You can move forward with an alternative layout and keep a command of both layouts, like, in muscle memory. I know that for a fact.
Very nice.
And you started with Colmack, right? You said you're up to 30.
I did. And part of what got me into it was, I've been a hunt and peck, look at the keyboard typer for so long. Right. And like, I, just the other day, I was at a cool co-working environment in Santa Cruz called Nextspace. And I saw this dude hammering his MacBook. He had a black plastic MacBook, and like, the table was kind of vibrating on how hard he was hitting his freaking keyboard. And I was like, God damn, they build those things pretty good if that thing still works. But anyway, he was straight staring at the keyboard and like, cha 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 on the keyboard. And I'm like, whoa. And I was like, you know, I like the idea of being able to touch type. And, you know, part of that's why I'm learning Colmack, is I want to touch type and I want to do it fast. And I never want to think about, you know, having to find a key again. I just want my fingers to be like, bam, there it is, done. So
if you did a survey of Nextspace, how many people would and would not be touch typists?
The most would. And I think if you went into any high-tech environment, you're going to find touch typists. If you, any large company that employs, you know, digital freaking team that does anything, most people who are typing anything would be touch typists. And it's, I believe, becoming rarer to be a hunt and peck person in like this type of digital world we're in.
Right. So from the casual observer, someone like myself who is interested in Colmack, I mean, that's the first thing that came to mind was, I'm going to have to unlearn QWERTY. I'm going to be at this disadvantage, and I'm really glad to hear that, actually. Like,
No, they even recommend, as you're practicing, they said something like 2 hours a day practice at the new layout would be the fastest way to learn. And I have not been up that much. I more do it like 2 hours a day every 2 or 3 days or something like that. But they said also, you know, switch back to QWERTY and make sure, you know, your fingers remember that. And then that way you can back and forth, whatever you need to do, you're ready to go.
You can be hardcore.
Fully. You can be next level in any layout you want. So, you know, people speak multiple languages too. Like, I want to learn Japanese eventually. I've messed around with it before. I haven't got serious. And, you know, you go there, you learn it, you do whatever, and then you come back. And you're not going to completely forget English. It's, you know, you learned it and you spoke it for that long. So, as a random little anecdote to keyboard layouts.
Definitely. So, I have a comment from Neil who told me a bit about Ultra VNC SC, and for everybody who's listening who doesn't know what that is, it's Ultra VNC single click, and just search for Ultra VNC SC, and it will take you to
the space in between the S and the C.
And what that essentially does is it takes away all of the tasks that you would normally have to do to set up VNC on your client's machine, and takes and sort of reverses it up a bit. So if I need to help someone like Ben with a problem that he's having, I can simply send him an executable. He can run the exe, double-click it, and then I can then see his desktop without him having to forward his ports. He doesn't have to install a server. He doesn't have to do all those complicated things that, you know...
Dude, it's kind of like Sub7 or Netbus. That just came to me just now.
Yeah, basically. It's sort of like doing that, except that it's not permanent, and it's easy to... You can close the connection at any time. Those nice little features.
So, Ben, are those... Sorry to cut in, Sam. Those things you just mentioned, are those also software RDP solutions, or...
Sam, you want to take this one?
I've not heard of those.
I'm just curious. I know about Ultra VNC, and the single-click thing sounds cool, but I've not heard of the ones Ben just mentioned.
That's very interesting. Okay. Well, Sub7, I believe, was the original in Netbus.
I think Netbus was the original one, and Sub7 was derived. But regardless of who came first.
All right. Well, anyway, they're essentially it was a really early virus, pretty much. And anyone could install the server end of it on any system. And so all it did was it would install itself. I don't think it was a service, because they didn't have services at the time, I don't think. But what it did
I mean,
is...
service is an academic term, but it wasn't running in the Windows service system, that's correct, but I mean...
Right. I think it just basically started up every time you started Windows. Right. Like, I doubt it was that hard to remove. and so what it did is it opened up port 12345, not 6, right?
I think it's 12345 6.
Okay, it opened up that port.
No,
and then
five. Just 5, whatever. Anyways, yeah.
And so it would open up, and then you would use the client end, connect to it, and then you had essentially full control over that computer.
Wow.
You could then put a password on that computer so that nobody else could port scan it and then take it over. Mm-hmm. So then it would be basically your little computer. And mind you, at the time that this was like possible to do, everybody was on dial-up. So
this was a long time ago, and it was like these were remote hijack type things.
Yes.
Pretty much, yeah. And so when you had control over that computer, let's say you wanted to see what they were actually doing on their screen, you would have to take a screenshot. And doing a screenshot of a 640 by 480 computer over dial-up, I mean, it would take... I remember it being like... I don't know. I had a 2400 baud modem, so it was a little slower for me than everyone else, I think, but... it would be somewhere between 7 and like 10 minutes to get that screenshot. So they were done doing whatever it is that they were doing. But what was faster was opening up the keylogger. You could see the keys that they were typing in real time.
Yeah.
And that was much easier. You could just tell, they're probably like doing this, probably doing that, typing URLs, you know.
Gotcha.
Like everybody typed.
No, I've not heard of that. I probably came on the scene after you, so... That's good to know about, and obviously this was a while ago talking about dial-up modems and such, but it's still a good little piece of history there. I hadn't heard of those before.
Yeah, but you know, you'd certainly be able to... I wonder if you could even do it now. Like, if I were to set up your antivirus to accept Netbus and install it on your computer and then
probably
lock it with a password...
Windows 7.
Yeah, probably not.
But on that note, there obviously are, you know, stuff, there are tools out there in this day and age to do similar things. It's just that it's changed a lot.
So. Right. But the point of this whole conversation was that Ultra VNC is like a legit version of one of these illicit programs.
That does happen. If we talk about something for long enough, I will completely forget what started it or what we're talking about or what's going on. So it's good. It's good to bring us back, Ben. Thank you.
So speaking of Windows 7 and that, this listener was talking about Arrow, right, Sam?
Mm-hmm. So with Arrow, starting in Windows Vista and Windows 7, essentially Ultra VNC single click has a really difficult time rendering that out, which is strange because it works pretty well with just the standard Ultra VNC. I mean, I usually leave it on most of my client systems so there's no big jarring glitch when it switches to the Arrow Basic, because it just looks
pisses
awful.
People,
they don't know what's going on. I'm like, just forget it. I'll just leave it on. And it usually works perfectly fine. It's not a problem. But with Ultra VNC single click, the issue I had was a massive delay of about 20 seconds. And at the time, I was out of the country. I was in China, but the lag was still way longer than when I connected via regular Ultra VNC, which was, you know, a delay of a maximum of 2 seconds, you know? So with single click, I didn't realize that turning Arrow off would make such an enormous difference, but I guess it does. I haven't tested that out yet. But he suggested using TeamViewer, and he just said he got fed up with Ultra VNC single click as a solution. But if you want to try it yourself.
So he bailed completely on it. Was he having other problems, or was it, you know, based on that? I guess we don't know, huh?
Well,
it seems like that was kind of the fact of the matter.
Yeah, huh. That was basically it. But if you want to try out Ultra VNC single click yourself, what you want to do is go to the website, and setting it up is a little awkward. So if you're not really comfortable with I don't even know. You have to edit this INI file, and then what you want to do is lock down your own IP address using something, either get a static IP, which you probably don't have, so get something like the Dynamic DNS, Dyn DNS Updater, search for that program, and then get the associated service, and then you put that in as your host name, and then the default is port 5500, so you want to open that up on your end, lock down your local IP, then you have your Ultra VNC viewer listener, or it's just the Ultra VNC viewer listener, opened on port 5500. So then your host computer is then listening and waiting for that client computer to connect to you. So once you got that up, they'll basically double-click it. But there's a really strange thing on the website with Ultra VNC single-click where you have to log in using this I forget what the username is, but the password is foo, and the username is foo or something like that, and then it like compiles the exe per your host file that you just edited with all that information. So you upload that file, and it gives you an exe back, and it's just it's a little weird. So like, because you have to, you know, you like screwed up something, you put in the wrong board number.
So they're compiling it for you, but the compile is in the cloud, and it's really awkward.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool that they're doing it for you and they give you this one EXE, you know? That's really neat.
Cloud compiling is something that some people have tried that even for microcontrollers, dude, where the whole tool suite's all on in your browser and you load files up and you can like basically build binaries and then it downloads it to your file system, right? And then this thing was a little USB thing and you just drag and drop from your downloads folder onto the, you know, microcontroller and it would just boot it. When you power cycled, it would boot that new binary. It's very interesting. Sorry, that's like distracting. But
no, that's really neat, though.
No, it's good to hear about stuff that's going on in the cloud, because I kind of have a feeling stuff is moving in that direction. I don't know that it'll ever all be there, but there's a shift happening, obviously, and it makes sense for a few different reasons. That's my personal opinion. Again, I have sometimes some idea what I'm talking about, other times not so much.
Yeah, so They do a little compiling for you, which is nice. You get the EXE, and so give it a try. Turn off Arrow. See if that works for you. Email addresses, Ben. I'll take that away.
I just like to pimp our feedback, our listeners, specifically Neil. His website is digitallama.net. You should check that out. Specifically talking about emails, one of our listeners sent us an email, and he did something pretty cool. Basically, he owns his domain, you know, whatever, and he is using a catch-all email. So, you know, you guys all have web hosting. You know that catch-all where all the spam and all the different things all filter into.
Yeah.
And one thing that our listener did was he used a specific name that was just made up that was referencing us at hisdomain.com. And so I used to do this back when I was a kid. The reason that you would do something like this is that it'll come into the catch-all, so you can use a website, a URL. I'm sorry. You can use an email address to register on those random shady websites, and then if they start sending you spam, you'll know exactly what website it came from. I guess our listeners think that we're random and shady because we're going to start spamming.
Just as a side note, I can personally endorse portforwardpodcast.com. It's not random nor shady.
No,
you have my word on that.
And we will not be spamming you anything. But I would just like to point this out because I did this back in high school.
No, it is a cool idea. And when I first, you guys were talking about it pre-show, I was like kind of reading something and not paying attention. But now that we're talking about it again, it is a very cool idea because you can set up unlimited email addresses.
Yeah, literally
as many
infinitely
as you need.
Characters long, doesn't matter. It'll all come into that catch-all.
So for every time you register for some new service where they're like, no, you have to enter an email address, you're like, God damn it. So you type in just what this guy did. You'd be like, super cool free animated GIFs at mydomainname.com.
Exactly.
So then when you start getting that total worthless spam crap from that website domain, if that exists or not, you can easily just add that to the, you know, the garbage for it, or the, whether you section that one off and have it go straight to trash or whatever. There's a bunch of ways to handle it, but it's a cool idea if you want to learn how to get into the administration of your own email. You have the power to protect yourself then.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I used to do that. I had a domain, genplan.com, genplan.com.
As before, don't go to that website.
Yeah, don't go there. And I would set up this catch-all, and I was in high school, and I just was new to the internet. And so I for about 2 months, I would make up these emails that would go to my catch-all for all the different websites I was going on to. And after about two and a half months, I was like, that's kind of boring.
Kind of got tired of it.
And so I just kind of used, you know, Ben at GenPlan.
Yeah.
Then, right at that same moment where I was kind of getting lazy, I started getting a lot of spam. So before, I wasn't getting any spam.
Man.
So for the first 2.5 months,
yep,
it totally was worth, my time was worthless.
If you hate spam, learn to set up your own email and admin your own email, and then you can rise above the garbage that is on the internet.
And the final listener we feedback is from Norbert Herman. He wanted to know if he could download the MP3s of our episodes on the website. And he couldn't find it, and he's correct. Before, there was just a little Flash player that just comes with WordPress. Like, I didn't spend that much time setting it up. I just kind of threw it up there. So he would like download links. So I put those in every single episode, so you can just click on that. It just says, you know, download, and then it says the name of the episode, and that's at the very bottom of each after the show notes and all the links and stuff. Another thing that he said after I responded to him is he said, thank you very much, very cool. He said, I suppose in the end there are a few people left who are not the slave of Steve Jobs and the like. Best wishes from Cologne, Germany, Norbert. I thought that was pretty funny because he and I were talking about, you know, he could get it on iTunes or different ways he could subscribe to our podcast. Obviously, we recommend just using your RSS podcasting client. You can search on your iTunes or on your, you know, Android device for Podcaster and then add in our RSS feed. But it's pretty funny. I don't know. So thank you very much to him.
That's awesome that we got a listener in Germany, Norbert. I want to mention real quick, your country's awesome for a couple reasons. One, beer. That's big over there. And two, the Autobahn. I mean, are you freaking kidding me? No speed limits. Oh, my God. Anyway.
American Autobahn is fun there. Exactly. Real quick before we transition, our RSS link is just feeds.feedburner.com and then /portforwardpodcast. So if you have any some random, you know, RSS reader that doesn't, you know how to search any podcast directories, just punch that URL in and you can subscribe to us.
All right. So, Duke Nukem Forever.
Yes, about this. There's a history here, and you know, I remember when I first played Duke Nukem, it was like, whoa, this is a dirty game. Because right in the beginning, you know, there's that whole, like, little adult theater or whatever it is, if I recall correctly. And, you know, there's, you know, strippers and the like. And I was a little kid, and I thought that shit was awesome.
I thought it was so cool. I was like, this is the best game ever.
I should qualify my maturing there and say I still kind of think Duke Nukem's cool. But I have not played the new game yet, and a couple of the early reviews are not so glowing. Have you guys heard anything different, or?
I played the whole thing with my little brother last night and today. So
wow, awesome.
Report on that in a bit. Ben, did you
No, I did get a chance. I'm going to wait till it comes out and I'll buy it and I'll see what happens.
All right.
Wait, so you're talking about you just played the new one then,
yes.
Sam? Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So I thought we'd discuss that for a second here. But Ben, you played the original one.
Yes,
right?
I did. I did play the original
one. Do you remember?
We used to have LAN parties at Kirby with all the nerds would all get together and it'd be like four or five guys on their laptops.
Wait, what was your group called again?
Kirby was the place where we
were
gathering.
Okay, because I heard herpy, and we should just like clarify
no,
that.
No, it was Kirby, like the Kirby. Little pink guy. Or the
go
little,
on, Kirby,
little
yeah, the vacuum cleaner, that's fine, go on.
And there was like five nerds there, all with their laptops, and they would have it set up. They would be in like, I don't know, this one arena all playing multiplayer, and they had it set up so that when they walked forward, the boot would also be kicking the whole time, because you could kicking the boot wasn't a penalty against shooting or anything else. So they would all just walk around kicking their boots, just kicking the whole time, and try to run into each other and shoot each other, and it was fucking hilarious.
Dude, I totally just nostalgia'd for LAN parties when you were talking about that. It takes you back when you think about when you used to lug a computer somewhere so you could play dudes like an online game. That's so awesome. Remember back when you had to take your computer somewhere to play your friends' video games? It was a simpler time.
Yeah. I remember when we had to take our computers to each other's houses.
We had to walk uphill like. Both ways to school to drag our computers to a goddamn mang party.
That reminds me, Quake 1 was out, actually, Ben, before you were at Kirby.
And
we used to use a null modem cable to connect between each other. We didn't even use the LAN.
Yeah, I know. Awesome. It's crazy.
Awesome. It's even more old school. But the game is...
As a quick background, Sam, sorry to interrupt. I'm curious.
No,
what other first-person shooters have you like played that are recent, or do you?
Crysis 2.
Okay, so you that's the thing. Part of me was like, oh, well... This I was skeptical of the review. I'm like, I should buy it right now and try it out and see if the game sucks or not. And then I was like, well, I don't really have anything to compare it to because I'm kind of busy. I don't have much time for gaming. So that's
right.
Why I was curious.
Yeah.
Thanks for
yeah. It usually takes me forever to get the time to like actually get through a whole game. And
nice.
So for Crysis 2, I made an exception just because I thought that they did such an epic job with all the work and it just felt like a huge production. And so I just got the time to get through it. But if you look at this game from, like, if you had never played Duke Nukem before or never even heard of him, and I've met tons of people who just have no idea what that is, they're like, well, what? Who the hell is Duke Nukem? So if you have it from that perspective and you play this game, I don't think you really give it a chance at all, even. It wouldn't be amusing to you in any way. And it definitely doesn't hold up with modern titles very well. There's certain aspects of, like, certain boss levels, like they have bosses that seem rather large and are...
Like physically large?
Yeah, they seem physically large and they're convincing and the environments are pretty good. Like, they're up there, but it has a very, like, dated quality to the whole thing where it feels... like it's stuck in a 90s setting where like certain types of gameplay are just not really okay anymore. Like they still have like certain puzzles in there, like physics puzzles too.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it feels like you can't really go back. I was surprised to see that they had certain modern things, like there was no health packs, for example.
Okay.
But overall...
I honestly, the health pack thing bothers me. I'd rather... Like, the Halo 2 or the Halo 1 way of playing bothers me. Yeah, I'm not down.
Halo 1 had health packs?
No, they didn't. It's where you just recharge. You get hit, and then... Or maybe that was Halo 2, I guess. But basically, after a while, your shield goes down, and then it goes back up. Whereas
right.
The opposing way is to have no health packs, and I really like the health packs. I think that... Whatever, but...
Okay. Now, this game has the recharging thing, and it's called your ego. It's not called your health. So your ego, your mojo, it recharges as you duck out of the way. But the game, I don't want to spoil it if anybody's really excited about playing it, but, there's no way you can't not play it. does that work, double negative-wise? I mean, because it's just been such a joke for so many years, it's like I couldn't just be like, oh, I'm over it and stop playing.
Yeah, this really was a lingering thing, right? They were supposed to be out with this game for forever. Is that what was going on?
The first official release date was 1998.
Wow.
I mean, this is as big of a thing as Sony getting hacked is, honestly, in terms of, like, impact on the history of the internet, right? I mean,
pretty much.
Joke has been going on for longer than Sony. I mean, it's not as much coverage, obviously, but...
You could say, as far as me not having any idea, I'll bet Duke Nukem Forever was supposed to come out before the term vaporware existed.
I'll bet you it did.
But it's not. It's out now. It's not vaporware. It just was thought of that way for a while.
If one of the... it's always... been a thing, even when there were, before Vista came out, there was all these jokes that they're like, oh, awesome, I can get Vista when Duke Nukem Forever comes out. So, I mean, I don't know what I'm going to use for my jokes anymore.
So is this out on PC yet too, or did it just come out on consoles? Do you guys know?
Like, I think it's out on everything. I played it on PC. I don't do consoles.
So. Gotcha. I saw the first bad review on Google News when I was under the tech and sci section or whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. And another review I found did actually have links to Metacritic.com, which is a keeping score of entertainment, their tagline. I guess they, keep the ratings of different games. And they have, for the PC version, the game has a score of 62 out of 100 based on 9 reviews. And the PlayStation 3 version has a score of 58 out of 100 based on 12 reviews, and the 360, 50 out of 100 based on 21 reviews. So I actually lend more credit to these game reviews than I do the people who are, science, technology, journalists, because they might just be making review for it to grab headlines. That's what I feel. Sometimes you'll see articles that are a little bit sensationalist. It's my random little thing. But anyway.
Right. But, this game has enough to make it worth playing. It's amusing in a lot of parts. The parts where it sort of falls apart is with the dated gameplay. Like, it has certain little, puzzle areas where you're just, you either don't really quite know what the game wants you to do, forget what you're supposed to even be doing. It's like you're sort of around a circle, and it's like, what are you doing? And I feel like when you're playing it, there's no way that you can't not get stuck in certain parts. Because it's like, really? What's going on here? And, I mean, when you play it, which I guess both of you eventually will, you'll see what I'm referring to. But it's certainly
so you're saying that's opposed to like a Half-Life 2 kind of physics games where it's pretty obvious what you're supposed to rearrange the boxes to do,
I don't remember stuck in Half-Life 2.
No, but I mean there was definitely room puzzles. Like Half-Life always had room puzzles from Half-Life 1, and I'm just wondering because I haven't played Duke Nukem Forever. If you're saying that these versions of room puzzles are just awkward, right? I mean,
they're a little bit awkward. But there's one part in the game where there's a bunch of levers and pulleys or something, and Duke says something like, "Damn, I hate puzzles," or something, which would be funny if you could just keep going, but I don't know, but then you still have to do the puzzle, so I'm like, okay.
So as far as Half-Life is concerned, now that you guys reminded me about that, that was the first game, PC game, until I think back through my whole gaming life, that was the first PC game that, fully blew my mind, and I was like, this is so fucking awesome. And I just remember playing that game into the wee hours of the morning and being just blown away. And not to say that there wasn't legendary titles before that, but that was the first one that was special to me and is amazing. And I kind of have a special place in my heart for that franchise now. And when Portal came out too, it was this is a random fun little thing. You start playing and then you get sucked into it. And then 8 hours later, you're like, oh my God, what just happened? So that franchise does a good job with their stuff. That's props to whichever company is behind that.
Steam, it's not Steam, it's Valve, right?
Yeah, Valve Software. Yeah. The guys behind everyone at Valve, you're awesome. I love you. Peace out.
Did you, either of you, play Portal 2 yet?
I've not. I didn't want to lose a few days.
Sam, it's so funny. Sam, you play more video games than I do, and I used to consider myself a huge gamer. I'm so trying to
We toned it back.
Merrick and I are, trying to release our ventures. So.
Yeah, we're
Sam, what's going on with you?
I don't know. Something like Portal, I can't pass up. Duke Nukem Forever, can't pass up.
No, no, that's awesome. I'm glad you at least did play that so we can talk about it and not sound like complete assholes who have no idea what you're talking about, which I do
sometimes.
It's diversity. No, it's good we have actual user experience here.
Very well. It's usually the other stuff that I'm like, what? Oh, yeah, I'm never going to get around to that until like 5 years later and everybody forgot all about it or something. Anyway, Jump lists.
The Venture Beat, there was a review for Duke Nukem Forever. That's what Sam was reading. We'll put that in the show notes.
Okay.
I was on Facebook with Sam, and he posted something hilarious on my fucking thing.
What did I post?
Jump list. I posted to you. Basically, what I said, that if you take your mouse on Windows 7, just using a mouse, no touchscreen, and you click and hold on one of the icons in the taskbar, and then you drag it up, you get the right-click menu. So basically, you can get a right-click with only using your left mouse, just by doing this click and then drag up. And that's called a jump list, right, Sam?
Correct.
Whoa, I totally didn't know about that, and I'm trying it, and it's cool.
It's cool.
He's like, whoa.
It's working right now. I can verify this is true.
Yep, I do this.
What were you
going to
say about that stuff, Sam?
I like the little animation here, because it's smooth, and I always like the idea of slowing it down, like that shift minimize in OS X that you can do.
Yeah, where all the windows kind of...
I like that stuff. I'm a big sucker for it. Anyway, the reason why they made this exist, because obviously that's kind of an awkward way to right click on your menu, right?
Yeah.
It's not designed to replace it. But if you're on a touchscreen device, you need to bring up your right click menu. You could do some awkward click and hold thing or whatever, but they figured, why don't we just click and slide up? Doesn't that make sense, right?
It's
totally intuitive on touchscreen. And so,
or even the touchpad on my laptop, I could see this being cool because I more often than not will be using my laptop without a mouse, and the
right
clicking on my Toshiba touchpad is annoying and hardly ever works. So yeah, awesome.
Okay, so yeah, just tap and then drag up, not too shabby. But Steve Ballmer made a really big deal about how Windows 7 was touchscreen enabled. He said, we worked through everything and made everything touchable, and it's designed for multi-touch and blah, 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 and everything like that. And so I was really excited about that when Windows 7 was in beta and everything. And when it finally got released, they had it available at all the fries and everything. The first thing I jumped to was one of the HP big screen touch things, because I was excited to get one. I'm like, this is cool. Like, it's going to have Windows 7 and be all touchable, and I imagine all the coolness. And so I did stuff that I would do. Like, I brought up in a picture, and then I grabbed both ends, upper left and lower right, and wanted to resize it to be small. And
you were expecting iOS, basically.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, they said that they made, like, the points larger, so you could just do something like that quickly without trying to, like, get all, you know, Windows Mobile 6.5 about it with a stylus, like, all perfectly lined up in the edges.
Right,
because that's what makes it... That's what makes touchscreen unfortunate, is when you're like all precision about it, because that's not...
Yeah.
What's the point?
The pointer is much more precise than a touch.
Yeah, and so I'm like hovering my finger over it, and when your finger is over it, you can't see exactly where that edge is, so that's where the whole Windows 7 touch thing is supposed to
be
fatter, cool, I guess.
Fatter than your finger, all the controls, so you can hit them, basically?
Yeah, and that isn't there on Windows 7. I don't know what Steve Ballmer was talking about. I'd like to see him use it and show me what he's referring to in all those keynotes.
So pretty much you got excited about it and you went and it was nothing like he said or you hoped, and you're like,
dude,
wow,
it sucks.
Like,
the only cool thing was the jump list. Like, I purposely clicked and dragged that up because I was excited about that. Like, day
that is
one.
Cool. Well, I guess so, out of maybe the 100 cool things they could have done to make touchscreen awesome in Windows 7, they got one right? Is what you're saying?
Pretty much. Yeah, I mean, jump lists are pretty neat for a lot of reasons. You can right click on a whole bunch of stuff and then pin them to the jump list. And then, so for example, on my Windows 7 partition on my desktop, I always listen to DI Radio, and so I have it on the Google Chrome jump list. So I just took it straight a link to the breaks. And so if I right-click on it or click and drag up, I can just click that, and it launches it super fast. So
how do you do that? Are you pinning it to the actual task bar or to the jump list?
To the jump list.
And how do I do that? Oh,
because
pin.
Chrome...
Oh, and then I right-click and I say pin.
Exactly, because Chrome is already on your pinned to your taskbar.
Right.
So therefore, if you pin something else to it, it goes straight to the jump list because it's not going to give you another icon.
And it has my most visited recently. That's very cool. I knew that right-click, they had expanded right-click, but I guess if I think about it, like the jump list there, that's a pretty cool feature. I didn't know about that.
No, it is. This is good feedback, too. If any Microsoft people ever listen to this, we'd like to see a little more touchiness in future Windows releases.
Windows 8, we'll find out.
Make it touchy.
Let's, instead of looking forward, let's look back. Back. Back to the days before we knew how to use computers. I remember that there was one feature of Microsoft Windows that when I found out about this feature, it blew my mind. Like, it let me know that computers were sick, they were awesome, they were here to stay. I could control them and dominate them and switch my Windows super fast with Alt-Tab. I remember I was at my high school and I saw this guy, Adam Field, just like switching Windows like a crazy
maniac. He was blazing through them, and you were just like, oh my god, how are you doing that? He wasn't even using his mouse, huh? He was just flying through.
Yeah, exactly.
You were like, dude, what are you doing?
And then, you know, I asked him what it was, and he told me how to use it, and I tried it on my laptop, and I just couldn't, I just have not gotten over how cool Alt-Tab is. Sam, when did you learn about Alt-Tab?
12 years old.
12 years old.
On Windows 3.1. Well, 3.11 for work groups, to be precise. Mm. And I don't remember who told me, but I remember just when I first did it. Have you guys used Windows 3.1?
Yes. I actually have used Alt-Tab on Windows 3.1, although that was actually when I went back to it from like a 95. So I learned it on 95, and then I used it on 3.1.
Okay.
And it still works just fine.
It does, but it's very different, though.
It is different. You're right.
Yeah, when you Alt-Tab, and I got... okay. The differences between Windows 3.1 and 95 are so dramatic in so many ways that it was very traumatizing to me. when you hit Alt-Tab in Windows 3.1, you don't get to see how many things you can Alt-Tab between. It just brings up one big square in the middle of the screen. It's showing you the next program it's going to switch to. So you Tab-Tab, and it will show you whatever it is open. Calculator. It'll just say Calculator in a huge blocks. So when you let go, the calculator appears. So you need to sort of know in your mind how many things are open to switch through.
But it was most recently used still, right?
Right, yeah, same thing. So
that's the most important thing. It's kind of like a stack. Like if you think of a stack of plates, and anytime you switch to a window, you remove that plate from the middle and you put it on the top of the stack of plates. Mm-hmm. And so now the plates that you use the most, aka the windows, are at the top. And so when you switch, you're moving down the stack of plates, and so you get the most recently used ones. This is something that Mac does not have, and it pisses me off to no end. If someone knows any kind of plugin for Mac that will let me have a most recently used Alt-Tab, I will flip. Macintosh tries to...
Dude,
I don't know. Maybe I'm retarded. Macintosh has Alt-Tab, but it just switches for right now. It just shows Chrome and then Finder. Yet I have six Chrome windows
open. I've done that before.
So they do most recently used, but not per window. It's per app, and it just makes me want to flip a fucking
So you do Command-Tab, right?
Command-Tab, right.
And then it only lets you switch between the actual application.
And between Chrome, you know, Terminal, and Finder.
So it doesn't let you do the child nodes, basically.
No child nodes.
Ugh. That's what I remember. I remember whenever time I would work on a Mac, it would like flash at things saying like Finder, and I'm like, okay.
And your Finder's your desktop, which doesn't show up. Or does desktop show up on Alt-Tab now? Yeah, it does now.
Mm-hmm.
On Windows.
So you'd switch to your browser, and it'd always be like the wrong tab, and I'm like, okay, it's sort of not really helpful. So I just found myself using Exposé, and I don't know. But it's certainly not as fast. I mean, you're a power user.
Most recently used, dude, because like when I have 15 windows open, that's the best way to sort them. And every time we do Exposé, where all the windows pop into little icons, I mean, that's okay, right? But if you delete one, they all shift. So my brain doesn't have a direct pointer to where the window is. I literally have to look at it. There's like no way for my brain to be like, okay, I need to get to that window I was just at. Just can't do it.
And what about... Mission Control. You excited about that? In Lion?
I am excited about that. Before we start talking about all that stuff,
okay.
I want to finish up with Alt-Tab with you.
Okay.
Was it the best thing ever?
It definitely was. I remember I took a solid, like, I don't know how many minutes, but I, like, mastered it. Like, I opened a bunch of stuff, and I hit tab.
You trained on alt tab. You're like, all right, this needs some training. You sat down, and you're like, alt tab, alt tab, alt tab.
And then I realized that you could do other things. I think it was, what is it? You could
alt shift tab.
I didn't realize that until later, but I realized that through shifting, you'd shift through open fields with just tab, and then I was like, oh, I gotta go back up, how the fuck, do you go back up, shift tab. Yeah. There was a period of time, Ben, where I didn't have a mouse. This is, I was still 12, uh-huh. And what I had is an original prototype of a laser mouse that my older brother got from his work. He worked at Texas Instruments, and so they had something with Logitech at the time, and the original laser mice, they had a special mouse pad. It was like a grid shaped.
It was a grid, and they could read they would just read that you were moving along the grid.
Correct. So if you move this mouse over your regular surface, nothing would happen. It just wouldn't respond. And of course, this is a serial mouse, by the way, no plug and play.
Right.
You had to have all the IRQ everything
set up right.
Yeah. Otherwise, you could forget about it. And so, because you could actually see this grid, if you moved your mouse over it and moved it slowly, you could actually see the mouse moving horizontal, vertical. Like it would jitter its way through the thing. And since it was a beta prototype thing, it eventually just died, and it wouldn't work at all. And it died slowly, too, so it was like this sad little mouse that would sort of like jitter through the
slow and painful death.
It was really painful, but I was like, I need my computer.
You go back to the keyboard, the trusted old friend with the keys that always work.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you learned how to navigate because of this shitty mouse situation you had, right?
Right. So eventually there was no mouse. And I remember going to Staples, wanting to buy a mouse, and my parents were not going to spend $100 on a Microsoft Intel mouse or whatever else was available. It was just all too expensive. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. A mouse was too expensive.
Well, but you probably were being a little bitch, and you wanted to get the laser one, and they were like,
there was no laser one
in the bin, and you're like, no.
Well, if IntelliMice were $100, I bet the rollers were still like 20 or 30 back then.
No, dude.
And obviously, if you go into a store every time with your kid and buy them something, they're going to become spoiled brats. So, I mean, to his parents' credit, maybe there was a reason he didn't need a mouse right then.
Let me clarify. There was no laser mice on the market except that beta one at the time. The IntelliMice was... All that meant was that there was a scroll wheel in the middle. There was still a ball mouse. There was no mouse that was, like, cheap, really. They were all $50, $70, crazy. Or whatever. That's what I remember. Anyway, so I couldn't get one. So I taught myself every keyboard shortcut that there was to know, basically. You could hit the Windows key and then push, like, Windows key 3 to Windows key 4, and, like, that would switch between open tabs. You could hit the Windows key and then hit tab in Windows 95, and that would actually cycle through. What it would do is it would highlight the individual open programs on the taskbar.
Before actually opening them
right.
up.
Right, and then when you would let go, it would launch it. So it's a little bit of an intuitive way of doing that. When you had an active window open and I wanted to move it, you
alt
would
space.
Do alt space, and then down, move, and then jitter out of the way. And learning that, I can't even tell you, Ben, how many times I've used that to fix a real problem where I have like an always on top virus window open or something.
Exactly, and you just alt space X or alt space
exactly.
N or any of that stuff.
And then you
stuff.
Move it out of the way, and awesome. I'm like, I don't know how I would do this any other way, or something's off the screen.
Exactly, you can't figure out when the bar is off the screen, what the hell do you do?
Right,
you gotta besides do. Alt space, you can't get at it.
Right, gotta get at those commands. So knowing those shortcuts, knowing those commands, and knowing the DOS commands, completely necessary in order for me to be able to.
That's funny that you had a shitty mouse situation. I heard some kid tell me his story about losing the mouse, and it was because his parents would ground him and wouldn't let him use the computer. So they just took his mouse as kind of like the keys to the car. So he kind of had to learn on the keyboard.
Well, if they left the keyboard, they screwed up, because obviously he just trained up on that. Then he's good to go. That's funny.
My mouse, no.
Yeah, wait until they were out the house and just mess around with the keyboard. That's so funny.
It is. I don't remember the first, I don't remember my alt tab story, but a more recent Windows thing that I like a lot, and this may have been in Vista, but because I held on to XP long enough to jump pretty much straight to 7, I think I tried, I don't know, it was like a matter of months, one or two, maybe three that I was Vista before 7 came out, and
like a real man should.
The shortcut little, what, I don't know what you call it, but you know how Windows, you hit the Windows button or you click on the Windows button and you have this little search program in files, the
R run box or what?
It's kind of like, you know...
Oh, the search thing where it, yeah. It goes through all your stuff,
it,
yeah.
It probably has a specific name, but I
it's
don't
called
even
instant
bother.
Search.
There you go, instant search. Thank you, Sam. Since instant search, I don't really use my start menu that much anymore, and I like it because you can hit your Windows key and you can type in what you're going for, and it's usually the first or second result you hit enter, and it's that much faster than sifting through all the crap that I've installed. So,
and I would take that to one extra level. If you get to Windows search, you need to press the start key and release it, and then press you just start typing. Mm-hmm. But if you want to get to the run box, which is very similar, you just hold start and press R.
Nice.
Yeah.
You can, using the combination of those, you can get to anything on your computer. And I have actually, on my desktop right now, if I minimize all my windows, I have no icons on my desktop. I don't use desktop icons.
Crazy.
I've migrated all the way to start R and then just start and then Windows Live Search. That's how I get to everything on my entire computer.
So do you organize like your stuff still? Like you have your folders with all your music or whatever in it? It's just, you know what they're called and that's how you get to them?
Well, I can go to my computer directly. Basically, I try to keep just my operating system on the C drive. And then I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 drives. One of those drives is actually a RAID 1. And I just put all my different music and things on the root of those other drives. So nice. I know, for instance, that Z has certain kinds of stuff. And the S has a certain kind of other stuff.
Wow, so you even keep it organized by drive. That's pretty cool.
So then I just do start run, you know, Z:/ folder name.
Cool.
Nice.
And I've gotten rid of desktop icons. And that makes it a lot faster when I want a VNC into my computer.
Oh, yeah.
Over
yeah.
SSH tunneling, of course, because I don't have to draw the background. And it's just a black. It's just black. Black pixels.
Plus, you know, as a random side note, I kind of like the idea of looking at a computer and like not knowing how to use it. Like, if people walk up to your computer and they don't see anything on the screen, they're like, "What do I do?" You're like, "Yeah, I'm hardcore."
Like your Colmac layout.
Exactly. No, I've not physically changed my keys yet, but as soon
as you do,
and they mentioned this again back to the Colmac website. They mentioned don't change your keys around if you haven't learned it yet, because that's going to encourage you to look at the keyboard, and that's part of the reason you're learning this is just so you don't look at the keyboard. Or my reason, part of my reason was I didn't want to look at the keyboard anymore. So all my keyboards are still physically QWERTY, but you can pop most keyboards. You can pop keys off and rearrange them depending on what and where and why
you,
and when.
You know what's even more hardcore? Have you heard about the DOS keyboard?
The blank keyboard.
I have one of those.
Hold on. We'll get there in a second. I'm jealous of your keyboard. We'll get there in a second. So that's what got me excited when I saw Bennett's MacBook. He had his Dvorak layout on there, and I was like, oh, that's crazy, and that spurred the whole discussion. And as soon as I'm hardcore in Colmac, I am definitely going to pop all my keys off and put them where they're supposed to be.
But if you had no desktop icons, or I guess if I had no desktop icons, and then I was rocking the DOS keyboard, which I'm not right now,
exactly.
And you sat down at that computer, you'd be like, what the fuck?
Okay, now we can switch to that. I stumbled on those, and the blank keyboard is definitely hardcore. That is the next level for sure, because I saw a couple pictures of those, and I'm like, no way, that's so awesome. And I was looking at them online. DOS Keyboard is the company that makes them, and
they've weighted keys too.
So. Yeah, these certain keyboards, Maximum PC, Awesome Magazine, they have a website. They did a roundup of high-end keyboards, and that's what got me into this little keyboard research phase that I had recently, randomly. And I found out that all high-end keyboards have a commonality, and it's these switches they use. They're called Cherry MX switches, Cherry space MX. Cherry MX switches are these super switches that, you know, there's three different flavors, and depending on which flavor you get, there's a tactile feedback, so when you key press all the way down, your finger is like, you get a little bump back knowing you push that key all the way down. So in addition to
just hitting the bottom of the rail, you get a little
bump. Instead of bottoming out a key, like most cheap or even average nice keyboards, I've got a Logitech G15 here in front of me I like a lot, but it is definitely not running Cherry switches. So the reason how I know a key is pressed is I hit it down and it makes a noise when it's at the bottom. But on these Cherry keyboards, it gives you a little bump, like, so your fingertips know you've hit it down all the way bottom. And then there's also an option to do a clicky noise. So you can do the bump or a clicky noise. And it depends on which type of Cherry switch you get in your keyboard. And so there are these, again, if you go to the Maximum PC article, they do a quick little summary of these keyboards. And they were raving about the SteelSeries 7G is like this invincible keyboard that uses Cherry blue switches, and blue gives you the clicky noise and the tactile feedback. And a kind of a caution is, if you get these clicky keyboards, they do make more noise than the traditional ones. So if you
don't podcast.
If you're podcasting or there's coworkers nearby, you're supposed to be typing in a quiet environment, forget about it. But it's random this even got brought up because I was not planning on it. And I was like reading the other day like for an hour about keyboards just straight. And I want to get a keyboard with Cherry Switches. I haven't got one yet. But you can find them kicking around on eBay. The Steel Series, and I don't have the article in front of me, but there were a couple others that have Cherry Switches in them. And if you're a very serious typist or you want to be hardcore about it, you can look at keyboards with cherries in them and see if that's something for you to try out. But again, back to the Colmac and the layouts, between Colmac and a blank keyboard and Cherry Switches and dual, triple, quadruple monitors, I think we could pretty much take over the world. I think that's possible.
Get our own little command center going.
That's how hardcore you would be. You would surpass the Warlock like instantly if you had multiple monitors and blank keyboards just laying about your workspace.
And you wouldn't know if it was Dvorak or you know.
Nobody would know. No icons anywhere either.
Yeah, you thought you were hardcore?
Think again.
Yeah, exactly. Say it in the Duke Nukem voice too.
Do you remember what that review said about the Optimus Maximus keyboard?
Oh, you know, it's funny.
It was for good keyboards.
No. They totally. This is what happened. And again, this is how long I was reading that day about keyboards. Mm-hmm. I read the whole article a couple of times, and then I started filtering through the comments, and like I get down a ways. I get pretty deep in these comments on Maxim PC's article. Or Roundup. It was Roundup of nice keyboards. And someone in the comments was like, what? You did a Roundup and there's no Optimus Maximus keyboard? And like, I didn't even really remember what it was at that. And I'm like, huh. And then I Googled it real quick. And it's the keyboard that has the little OLED screens on each key, right? That's the one we're talking about. Okay. Mm-hmm. The immediate comment following that comment was from someone else saying what you just said. No, this was a roundup of nice keyboards. So apparently, I remember reading originally about how that keyboard was going to be before it came out. I'm like, that sounds cool and crazy, and I don't know. I like the idea, but do you really need a screen on each key? And that was like the end of the thought for me. And then I didn't pay attention to when it came out, but apparently just based on that one comment and what you said now, apparently it was not that good of a keyboard for whatever reason. Even though it's cool to have a little screen on each key.
I'm going to tell you why it's not a good keyboard. I owned the Optimus Maximus 116 key OLED keyboard for about 2 years.
Awesome.
I bought it directly from the company because I just had to use it. You know, it's one of those things. It's like nobody I ever know owns one. I don't know where to get one. I want to use one, but how am I going to do that? I can't rent one. Mm-hmm. It just drives me nuts. You know, if someone said, here's the Optimus keyboard, borrow it for a couple days, have fun, I would have used it, and I would be like, oh, cool, okay, I'm over it. But nobody ever gives me that opportunity, so I have to fucking go buy it.
Yeah, with rare hardware like this, or especially expensive hardware, though, it kind of, you know, it makes sense. You're not gonna find it at Target. So.
Exactly. So no one has it. I gotta buy it. It retails for I think $2,500. I ended up buying it from their. It's the same company, but for some reason they sold it on eBay for like half the price. So I got it for $1,500. You know, real bargain for a keyboard. So all the keys and everybody's saying I'm completely nuts. I went on the Susie Orman show and asked her if I could get it. She said I could get it. So I fucking bought it. Plugged it in.
Sorry, what was that about the Susie Orman show?
I went on the Susie Orman show. She has a program. It says, can I afford it? And I asked her if I could afford
it. Oh, I know. She's like the money thing.
Yeah.
She's like the money lady.
So I figure, okay, she says I can get it, I can get it. So plugging the keyboard, turn it on, and it's this keyboard, man. When you take it out of the box, which is really nice packaging, and you plug this thing in, it is so heavy and dramatic looking. Like all the keys are like super glossy looking. And when you first turn it on, it makes this awesome. It's not really an animation. It's like an initializing screen, I guess, where they all turn white, and then suddenly they turn black, and then all the default keyboard layout turns on, and it looks so incredibly crisp and brilliant. Because they're OLEDs, so the blacks are like really deep black.
Really black, like right.
Uh-huh. And the
the OLED, do you know if they turn off for black, if they actually turn those pixels off, or was it just like a deep black?
No, they're actually off. Each
OS. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, that's I didn't know that for sure, but I am a fan of that because go back.
As a result, like when you're looking at it, it looks sort of, I don't know how to describe it other than it just looks really vivid somehow. And like each one of the colors is just really, really sharp and crisp, and it just looks fantastic. And each key can do each key can do 30 frames a second.
Wow.
But it's sort of limited by the hardware, so when you start having them all animated, they start to slow down.
Yeah, so you can only get so many frames per second, but each key can run at a higher frame rate, but not so all the keys can run at the same time. That's pretty interesting.
Right.
Probably just don't have RAM to buffer all that stuff into the display driver.
That's probably
That's like complicated stuff.
It is super complicated. I followed this keyword for a long time just because I thought it was such a cool concept, and the design of it looks fantastic. Like, you can't get over, like, looking at it. It just looks fantastic. Using it is fun to look at. You know, every time you look down, it's just like, whoa, I can't believe this keyboard is, like, so cool looking, you know? And when you hit the shift key, all the keys transform to be uppercase.
That's so cool.
And, like, the way it transforms, it has this delay to it, and it has to be not on purpose, you know, but you hit shift and it just like it's like a wave that goes over the keyboard of them all transitioning, you know. I'm sure it's supposed to be instant in theory, but you know, it's gotta,
well, it has to index them. I mean, it's doing a giant for loop, Sam. It's saying for each key.
So you don't think they did that on purpose though?
As
like another cool little like look thing or feature thing?
No, but it does look really cool.
I would say that they probably said we have a limitation how we're gonna do it, and then so they say we'll sweep it. You know, that's probably how they came around to it. Like, they made something cool with the limitation that they had. You have to do that when you're doing embedded systems. That kind of stuff comes out all the time, and sometimes it's elegant. Anyways.
So using the software they give you is called the Optimus Maximus Configurator. And, you know, it's got some ridiculous version number, like 0.32. This whole thing feels like a beta operation. And you don't realize that at first until you start getting into that software. It's extremely confusing. And this gets me back to how you're talking about scripting versus programming. It's basically like a big scripting language that you have to sort of get used to, even though they've applied a GUI to it, so it's sort of easier. But to get the keyboard to use it to its fullest potential, it would benefit Ben more than it benefits me. Because
you have to do commands.
Yeah, like you can stick in code, which is really, really cool. Like, I could see that, and I'm like, wow, I wish I knew what to type in that little field to make it do this cool thing that I want it to do. But I could do enough with the GUI to make it interesting. Like, for example, I wanted the shift key to turn red when I hold down the shift key every time. So I messed around with it enough to make that work. So as I'm typing, I hit shift, and it just, like, you know, I could, it does that. I was able to make it so as I type, every time I hit a key, like, it would change colors. You can make it do all sorts of nifty stuff like that. I rendered the letter A and QWERTY in 3D Studio Max, rendered those out to the proper frames and stuck those in so they could sort of like spin around.
Oh, that's cool.
See what that looks like. That's how I discovered the limitation of the...
frames per second.
Exactly. Because it started to slow down the more I would add, and I was like, oh, it's too bad. So if I did the entire thing, it would have been all like...
It would have been sick, but it wouldn't have worked. And
it would have been all jerky, yeah.
Yeah.
But, so here's where it really fell apart, though, is each key is slightly larger than a regular keyboard.
Right.
Oh, so it's not the standard US 101 key size or whatever?
I don't think so. So when you're typing, you're constantly fucking up.
Your finger, because you're used to touch typing, and your fingers are like, these keys are bigger. So
that's right. And I don't look
sense.
At the keyboard when I type, which is too bad, because I wanted to stare at this keyboard the whole time.
Yeah.
But I'm always hitting the wrong keys, and... like, the keys that are further away, like the shift key, like the Z key, Q, things like that, they're not in their blog. They said that they purposely, like, weighted them differently so they'd be easier to push because...
But they're not.
But they're really not. Like, you push them...
I don't know. I did use this keyboard for a couple sentences. I didn't really play around with it as much as you did, Sam. Tell me if this is correct or not. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is that the keys can press... directly up and down, they're kind of okay. But if you start to push them at an angle, they're not so good.
That's right.
So, yeah, that's a virtue of really good keyboards, is that you can push them kind of down at an angle and they work great. Obviously, that means for the keys that you're reaching, because your fingers are reaching out, there's kind of a diagonal angle to the pressure that you're adding on the keys. And so this keyboard just sucked at that, right?
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. When you push it, it's like it would sort of jam. You have to push extra hard on it, which slows you down tremendously. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm trying to type a sentence here.
Wow. So between the fact that you had to push it straight down and the fact that, you know, these fringe keys were further away than you thought they're supposed to be just because they're larger than...
And that effect multiplies with the more keys you move away. Yeah.
Right. And so then, you know, you're doing stuff, and one of the... Hold on, real quick. One of the really cool things that you could do is it... With the software runs in the background, the Optimus Maximus configurator. And you can tell it, so, for example, if Microsoft Word is open, to switch the whole layout to correspond to that program that's open. If I switch back to the desktop, it can do that wave thing again and switch right back to desktop mode or Skype mode.
Oh, that's cool. Like,
you can change all that. So I had a lot of that configured. So when it would load something else, it would just switch right over. But given the fact that I could barely type, I was constantly feeling like I just want to put this thing away and put it plug in my old keyboard. So for that reason, I just ended up having
it. I suppose it's hard to take something you paid $1,500 for and put it in the closet on top of some other junk.
I did. I put it back in its original box. I'm like, oh, I'll mess with that later when I have like more time to fuck around with the configurator, or I just come up with like all sorts of excuses to put it back in the box. So I put it in the box, put it away, and every like 6 months I would like take it out again and it would look all cool again. And then I would use it and I'm like, I just can't fucking type on this thing.
How long was your initial honeymoon period, if you will? Where you kept it actually at your desk?
I actually use it, it was about 2 days.
Wow.
Yeah. So if you divide mathematically by the number of days I actually used it, it was probably like rental.
You
cost.
Sold it, didn't you? So you recouped some
of that? I did sell it, and the person who bought it paid way more than I paid for it. So
nice.
I barely used it, so it was practically brand new.
So what
new.
Was your profit, dude? Did you make good profit?
Yeah, I sold it for $1,799, and somebody hit the buy it now.
Oh,
nice.
So I made a bit of profit. And this is after like 2 years, 2.5 years. So I don't know. So I didn't feel like such a chump after all. You know, everybody told me the joke was on me for buying it. And I saw
apparently
a lot of them on
joke
eBay
was
going.
On them for, you were investing in a...
Because it was an investment.
Because it was a durable good, and you got to use it the whole time of your investment, so that's pretty good.
That's true. I saw a lot of them on eBay going for like $800, and I was like, oh, God, I'm so fucked up. But because mine wasn't all like, screwed up and scratched and beat up, I guess it was fine.
Yeah, you kind of, the keys are clear, right? So that's another thing, is that as you use them more, they get dirtier and scratched.
Oh, yeah,
and
you could totally mess it up. If I used it full time, I could
definitely...
It would
have been dead. Yeah, it would have been done, yeah.
Another thing about OLEDs is they fade over time.
Could you see that they were faded over like a year or two?
No.
I mean, not you personally, but on this keyboard, what was a lifetime, I wonder?
It says that it lasts for, I think, honestly, 20,000 hours. They say that it lasts at like full brightness if you were to leave it, and that's how it would be. But then after that, it starts to fade gradually over the years.
Well, usually it's fading the whole time. You just can't notice it. It's usually like a negative 3 dB is where they cut that off. I mean, that's different, but yeah.
Okay.
It's usually where they'll do it.
So, yeah, eventually, I mean, they would get so dark that it would probably bug you, and then you'd want to replace all 116 keys. The cool thing is that you can just pop the keys out using a special little tool that comes with it. Click, click, take them out.
And could you take the screens out? Or
yeah, the whole key came out.
And how did that attach in? Was it a serial line, or...?
I never actually took one out.
That's interesting. I wonder how they indexed them all. Very interesting.
It's really a really cool keyboard. You just can't type on it. It totally ruins the whole thing.
Yeah, it seems to me, you know, I was suspicious, and I'm glad you used it. That's, you know, an awesome feedback story we have. When I first heard about it and, you know, pondered it, I imagined if someone used really specialized software, you know, where, like, it's useful to have a completely remapped keyboard and you weren't sure what your keys did, like, you know, maybe if it was some kind of rendering software or maybe even Photoshop, whatever, you know, how different key combos you can...
Right.
The more key shortcuts you learn in Photoshop, you know, the more efficient you are, the faster you can, you know, do graphic arts and such. So that's what I kind of imagined. But in you talking about it just now, I kind of realized that looking at the keyboard is going to slow you down no matter what. So you might as well learn to touch type, and specifically to whatever programs you're using, learn these key shortcuts, and you will be more efficient
You might as well go the opposite route. Instead of having lights on each keyboard,
you might as well get a blank keyboard. That's the only way you can become the most hardcore person in the world is to get a blank keyboard.
Yeah, I used my DOS keyboard for about my freshman year of college. So about, I guess, 9 months probably used it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I really like my DOS keyboard. I still have it. It's in good condition.
Maybe you can sell it for $17.99 on eBay.
I had a guy offer $100. I bought it for $100, but they were mostly going for $50. But since I have a Generation 1, the switches are different. They're not Cherry MX switches, but they're like a specific kind of switch, and they're different. They make a different. They make a click, I think.
Yeah.
I think they're the audible feedback kind, and the version 2 and 3 didn't have that. And so this guy, I never met up with him because he was in the city. I didn't feel like driving up there, but like I could have made $100. I mean, I might as well sell it. I don't really use it. But
you know that keyboard that everybody gets excited about, like the old folks, the IBM M2? See what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You do?
I do, actually.
Yeah, okay. I've heard of that. That was referenced in a couple articles when I was reading about keyboards.
I've never actually
like
used it. Is it really good? Is it really cool?
I'm going to do a little bit of Googling here.
I think just far as mechanical keyboards are concerned, that was like the first original invincible keyboard. Like, you know, remembering or recalling for sure, that probably had Cherry switches in it, and that's why it had, you know, this feedback and this click, and, you know, that's what made it go down as that keyboard. So you might have to, if one of you guys are looking that up, we can see if I'm completely off here or not.
But, I remember that the DOS keyboard was based on something that sounded like the M2, but I don't think it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm able to answer the question to what you just asked me, but yeah, gotcha. That was what I was looking up for. Yeah.
Well, we can have, you know, either some feedback on that or see if anyone knows the original.
I may have used one. I don't know. I slam all my keys really hard. Especially the Enter key. I don't know why. Just always had a habit of doing that. I mean, super hard on a select type, and I just get a great satisfaction of slamming the Enter key. And I've never, ever had a keyboard break, so they must all be pretty tough on laptops, on desktops, on everything. They just never break. So you can treat your keyboards pretty hardcore, I think.
Yeah, it looks like DOS keyboard is a Cherry switch, so definitely a nice keyboard to have.
Nice, dude. Keep it around.
Yeah, there you go. Why not?
So, keyboards. One more keyboard, and then we'll switch this one, I swear to God.
is that our limit? Do we have a certain number of keyboard limit that we hit? Or
I don't know. I like stuff like keyboards and like fun things like that.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, as much as we use our computers, you're interfacing the keyboard is your connection. That's like how you interface with the computer. So it's a lot of people will use the junk that comes with whatever, you know, Best Buy computer they bought, and they don't know what they're missing out on. When I first got my G15, I was stoked on like the different information I could display on this random little screen attached to my, you know, my Logitech keyboard here. And right now I have all my system specs up on it. And when I load up Wikipedia on Google Chrome and two of my cores go to 100% and then my mouse slows down and I'm like, oh, cool, that's what's happening right now. And I just happen to look down and I see my processor stats and I'm like,
So I want to stop you for a second. Your keyboard has a little LCD screen attached to the top of it.
It does, yeah. Sorry, if people aren't familiar with the Logitech G15, there is a monochrome LCD screen. It's like a 240 something by so many pixels.
It's like eight lines or something, 8 or 9 lines of text, right?
Yeah, just right now I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, 8 lines of information displayed, and there's some buttons surrounding it, and you can, through the Logitech software that comes with it, which is fairly intuitive and easy to use in contrast to the Optos Maxima software, supposedly, you can get all kinds of different stuff displayed on here, and you can cycle through the pages of displays you have, and you can interact with your different software, you know, your different programs with the keyboard and these buttons too. So like, you know, if you have your music player going, your Windows Media Player, whatever, your iTunes, you can interact with those programs based on the keys and the little screen too, depending on how much you get configured and set up. Some stuff is easy, other stuff you kind of have to mess around with it a little. But above this model is what they called the G19, which had a color LCD screen that maybe was even bigger. I don't know if it's bigger or not, but that was a cool keyboard also. And I don't have any experience with that one, but it's like the better version of this one, I imagine. Oh, the other thing is, which is good for gamers, is there's 6 mappable programmable keys all the way on my left-hand side here, G1 through G6, and there's 3 different memory modes up top, so you can cycle through 18 different, you know, profiles, or 18 different versions of these keys. sorry, three different versions of six keys, 18 options. So, you know, if you have whatever games you're playing and you need these custom keys set up, that's it's good for gamers too. I don't really use those, but those are popular from what I've read with gamers on my Logitech. And now that I've talked about this so much, I don't remember really where I was going with that. So sorry about that.
Well, I was just clarifying what you were talking about. You said that you had your CPU cores on there.
Yeah, I think
that's really cool that you can just get that little bit of feedback. But that was pretty much all they wanted to talk about that.
Definitely. No, I have the CPU, what is it, Z or ID?
Yeah.
One
right.
of those.
CPU Z, mm-hmm. yeah.
It feeds into...
That's so cool.
Core Temp. Okay. Core Temp is the one I'm running, and then you can download a little thing that makes it so Core Temp displays a page of information on my Logitech, and that's
so
how I got
cool,
set up.
Dude. So, I love that.
Yeah, nice. That's cool.
There was a little teeny tiny program that comes with the Optimus Maximus configurator that lets you turn any key into a RAM monitor, so show you how much RAM you're using, CPU monitor,
so
and then
cool.
all sorts of like fan temp controls, so you could.
So you can make your F1 through F10 because you know what those are pretty easily.
Correct. And so you could set a toggle. So for example, I set my scroll lock. Every time I hit that, it would replace all F1 through F10 with all that information. And you could look at all that real quick, then tap it back if you wanted to. So I thought that was a really neat thing about that keyboard. I remember when that keyboard that Merrick's talking about came out. I think it came out like 6 months before the Optimus Maximus did. And there was actually a lot of articles like comparing it, being like, you know, you don't need the Optimus Maximus, you can get this thing with the readout. That was pretty neat.
Very nice. Yeah. I think, Merrick, I think I just deleted what you typed in there. I'm sorry. I pressed Control Z on something you did.
Oh, well, that's okay. I wasn't watching that window, so no big deal. I figured it out.
There you go.
It happens. It happens to the best of us.
So, Ben,
your keys are currently labeled, right? So that's
yeah.
pretty much fail on you. Okay, just checking.
Ben, you used the laser keyboard at my house. Do you remember that?
The laser keyboard.
The projection keyboard.
Oh,
yeah.
Another keyboard, huh? All right. Yeah, this keyboard is pretty cool. It looks like a little, it's about as big as a box of baking soda, I'd say, and you set it kind of right in front of your desk, and it projects mm-hmm. down a little laser keyboard. It's like projecting the keyboard onto a surface, mm-hmm. and then it has a camera at a different height than the laser. It's a little bit lower down to the screen, I guess, or down to the table, and it watches where you put your fingers down on this projected laser keyboard. It's very cool. It's kind of hard to use, and it was like a Bluetooth connection, right, Sam?
Yeah, but you can USB it as well.
Yeah, it was really cool. Do you have anything to say about that keyboard?
No, I was just curious about your opinion, because you got to use it, and like...
Well, I had seen it a long time ago, and I didn't even... I just saw the chip. I saw that there was... I was looking... I guess my stepdad showed me a magazine, and they were talking about how someone had made a chip to do this. Like, they didn't make the final product, but they basically, you know... I mean, that's one way to make money. You invent the technology and say, here, you build a box, but we made the technology, you know? So
definitely.
You don't have to go the whole nine yards just to sell a product. You already did the part that you know. Anyway, so I wanted to use it, but I never got to see one. And we paired it up to your PC, and it was okay. It was kind of like, had a little bit of issues, like reading kind of where the keys were pressed. But besides that, I mean, I liked it. It was cool. I could see it being really useful for an iPhone if you could connect it to the iPhone easily, because then you can bust a keyboard out that's bigger than it physically is. The display, you can use like in a big area on a desk, but you don't have to put that area in your pocket.
Or even better, have this rolled into a future phone. Have this physically
not?
Built into the phone, because then you could set your phone up on a little stand or whatever.
With the stand,
and project
like that one
keyboard.
Phone that has the stand
yeah.
and then project it
yeah.
out.
Mm-hmm. That would be awesome if you could set your phone up with a keyboard on your desk.
Because
yeah.
I like to SSH into places, and I can do work on my little iPod, you know, because I can SSH
fully.
In, and I can SSH tunnel, I can do everything I need to get at my servers, so.
And you get that screen real estate back.
Right, you get the screen real estate back because it's now, you know, extracted onto your table. It's pretty cool.
That's right. It's one of those things. I wanted to use the keyboard, but again, nobody has one. I can't rent one.
So you just buy
it. I could buy it. So I took a lot of high-resolution photos and put those on a review on Variable Gigahertz. So go to variablegigahertz.com and just type CL850 review. There's a whole lot of high-resolution photos of how it looks, because I was... One of the things I was wondering, if you try and find photos of this keyboard, they're all really far away or really blurry or something, and I'm
right.
like, dude, like I want to see what it looks like actually.
Yeah, so you did like a little bit of a photo shoot. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I'm like, oh my god, somebody show me what this thing looks like. You know? So So, yeah.
So just to clarify, that was variablegh.com?
Yeah, variablegigahertz.com.
Sam, you really got to pimp out your stuff more.
Because I just typed in variablegigahertz.com. I typed it out, unless I spelled it wrong, and it didn't go to the right place.
Yeah, GHZ.
Oh, yeah. So variablegh.com. Gotcha.
Yeah, sorry about that. Sony security / PR debacle.
Yeah, no, it continues. There's just no end. And I'll bet Sony is shaking their heads at themselves about, you know, the roots, the why. They probably have had so many meetings about, you know, how this really happened and why this happened and why this is still happening and how...
The bureaucrats are meeting and their servers are being torn down by the internet.
Currently as we speak. And if so you don't funny. Believe us, you can check out a cool website called HasSonyBeenHackedThisWeek.com. And
if you go there, the answer is
yes for this week.
It's a big red yes. It's like a big PNG or something.
And there's both a hack history and the latest hack under that. And
we're up to 13 hacks right now, I believe.
Ben just told me about the site, and I laughed my ass off pre-show. And I made a comment about, you know, this is a freaking debacle, and it will go down in the history books as, you know, one of the more interesting cause and effect, you know, technological things that's happened in this, whatever you want to call it, this period of time. It's crazy. And there's not direct, you know, provable links or connections right now. There's a lot of speculation out there. I was surfing through some different news stories but on Google News about, you know, one of the two search terms I put in was Sony and debacle, because I figured I'd get lots of good results back on that, and I did. But there'll be a couple interesting news articles put in the show notes. But, you know, from my point of view, I believe it goes back to when that this guy GeoHots was hacking, you know, tinkering with the PS3, and, you know, he was just doing what he likes to do, doing what hackers like to do, and, you know, explore, you know, penetration tests, security tests, you know, find out what the limitations of hardware are, and his software, go on. And he got into this little legal tussle with Sony, not really on purpose. It's from what I know, there was no malice on his part.
Well, he was saying, you know, I don't want you guys to use this to steal games. I want you to use this so you can put Linux on the PS3. Mm-hmm. He was not endorsing a copyright infringement, but of course that's what Sony came down on his head
about.
Sony
was concerned about, you know, their profit in being able to sell games, and of course it is bad for Sony if all of a sudden every PS3 game is, you know, on BitTorrent or whatever. That'd be terrible for him, and nobody wants that, but he was just, you know, doing his thing, and so they take him to court, and bad things happen after that. And I remember thinking, it's too bad they're going after him this hard. Like, it seemed like excessive force to me. And so you look at that event, and then you look at kind of this digital backlash, and, you know, these different groups that came out of the woodwork. And
basically,
they're
like hacktivists, right? I mean, not quite. I mean, yeah, they're not trying to glorify what they're doing.
No, exactly. They, you know, the group that was behind, I guess the big one was Lulzsec, which is, yeah, Lulzsec.
LULZ and then SEC, which is shortened for security. So basically, it's security for the lulz.
And they it's not like they have some mission or they're even like specifically hacktivists, but
it's for the lulz.
Yeah, there's a Huffington Post article that talks about it in the show notes, and you know, there's I'm sure a lesson to be learned here from a corporate point of view about ways you can handle things and, you know, the cause and effect, what can happen if you were to go about it like Sony did. And, you know, it's been a huge, ridiculous nightmare for him. And it's not that, you know, this one thing directly caused the other, but it seems to me it's kind of like a cascade effect. Like, you'll look at, you know, Sony and the PR debacle that kind of had to do with this GeoHot thing, and then all these people are like, oh, well, you know, Sony's free game now since they're, you know, doing this guy dirty. So, you know, they get it from every angle.
They're a target. Not only, I guess they're free game, but, I mean, people started looking into them. And,
and so,
it was like a snowball effect, honestly. Yeah. Once the first hacks came out, people realized, let's penetration test their servers and see what's going on.
And, of course, they're open all over. And then, you know, this wasn't super recent. I don't know, you know, how long it's been off the top of my head, but Sony is still being taken down, you know, in different new ways all over. Like,
I think it's up to 13 hacks is what it was this week. So
and ouch. The other article that, you know, I heard about, we even mentioned last time, or I don't know if we did or not, that blew my mind was how one of their organizations, one of their subsidiaries or whatever, got hacked, and they were storing plain text passwords in a database, which is retarded. Absolutely retarded. That blew my mind that, you know, that was someone on Sony's size, regardless of what little group was doing it, had that happen. That's crazy.
Man, poor Sony.
Yeah, they you kind of feel bad. At first you feel bad for them. You feel bad for Geohot. You're like, oh, that sucks. Sony's suing this poor kid who'd like to fuck around with this beast. And then the whole world's like, fuck you, Sony. And they're like, oh, poor Sony's just trying to sell video games to make money. That's funny.
That's fucking funny, dude.
Totally.
Yeah, poor Sony.
So we'll see. I mean, it looks like it's going to keep going on from now on. So if you're curious about
is it sell Sony? Is that what that is? Is that like short Sony now or what?
I don't know. No, they're not going to go away. It's just it's a hard lesson for Sony. That's why I think it is. Sony's too big to fail. there's a fun little phrase. So it's a debacle and a corporate lesson. You know, there's lots of things that can be gleaned from this experience. And if you're curious, if Sony has been hacked this week, check it out. HasSonyBeenHackedThisWeek.com.
That's awesome. All right, next subject, if you don't mind. Last week we were talking about audio QR codes a little bit. Remember, Sam?
I do.
And you were concerned that if we were using tones to transmit zeros and ones, that there might be some problems. Like, for instance, if you had one tone for zero and one tone for one, the problem is, well, how do you know if you have a bunch of zeros in the way? And I couldn't find the link last time, but now I have it. In college, we learned about something called Manchester encoding. And basically, it's for solving this very problem. And the problem is you want a clock line and a data line at the same time. If you had two separate wires, right, you could have the clock that goes up and goes down. And you say, every time the clock goes up, I'm going to look at the data. And if it's high, it's a 1. If it's low, it's a 0. And so using the clock, that's like your timing. But if you have audio, you only basically have one line to transmit down. So this Manchester encoding, basically what it does is you take the clock and you take the data and you XOR them together. So what that means is that you should be getting a transition. If it was all ones, you'd still be getting a transition on every clock because they are combined into one signal. Anyways, it's a pretty cool thing. We learned about it in college. Maybe I didn't do the best justice explaining it. But if you'd like to learn more about Manchester encoding, take a look on Wikipedia or take a look in our show notes. Sam, I'm going to throw to you, and you're going to talk about ProBoolean.
Yeah, I will. About Manchester encoding, I'm going to need to read some more about that. I'm still confused about it.
If you look, I guess I don't really know how to describe it very well.
Yeah, I'm sure once I get it, I'll be like, oh, that totally makes sense. But it's one of those things. Because to me, it seemed to make sense the other way would just be to make, like, you got your zero tone, you got your one tone, and then you just make, like, another tone that's higher at a certain...
For your clock, and that's how you would break it up.
And just, like, pulse it between each one or whatever, and then...
Right, and that's how you know.
Right, but... Anyway, Manchester encoding sounds like a better solution for that, but I just don't know. Booleans in 3D Studio Max are a simple way of being able to edit some three-dimensional geometry around. You would take one piece, subtract another piece from it, and then you have a modified mesh, right? At some point... So the folks who make 3D Studio Max, Autodesk, introduced an updated version of this called ProBoolean, which fixes some of the major problems with Booleans where it usually would return all sorts of messed up geometry. And, you know, nobody ever gave me the memo.
Like, I don't know. You just didn't know.
Like, I was making all these models using the thing, thinking about how messed up the geometry is, and I'd go in and, like, fix it all. Which takes me back to welding vertices.
We talked about that
a couple weeks ago. And lo and behold, there's ProBoolean the whole time.
So this had been out for a while too, I guess, right?
I'm not really sure. I haven't even checked yet. I just got, you know, I brought up these show notes before we were talking. They got pissed off about ProBoolean and nobody ever told me. I mean, how am I supposed to know something like that? They like slipped it into the program. Like I hadn't used... A new version
and this was released by the same people, 3DS Max is group.
That's right, Autodesk. Okay. So
gotcha.
I don't know. Every time there's a new version of software,
I mean, I don't know how you're supposed to know if there's a new version or something like that. This isn't something that gets changed. It's been like this for over a decade. It's not something you just, like, update. So I guess it would have been big news, something like Duke Nukem Forever type news.
But, so that's an interesting little point to our listeners out there. Listening to the show will make you smarter, better, faster in all aspects of life.
Yes, and everything that you do, you should be better.
So does this happen in other things that you're doing?
I'm sure for every aggravation that we've had, there might be a better way to have it done. But you know, that brings up a good point. How can you really know about, you know, everything that's out there? I guess it's how much time you have to, you know, research a topic or try to find a solution. Certainly.
So if you do PHP programming, right?
Right.
So when you I don't know how that really works. Is there ever like new commands you can
The language is constantly being updated, and there's what is it, php.net
there's PHP 5 now. Oh well, yeah, .net is the I'm sorry, yes. I was thinking the language was called that. No, that's the website.
Gotcha. Yeah, the website. So that website, you know, you go there and, you know, when you're trying to remember like what a certain language construct or function does, you can bring this website up and it tells you about it. And they also have what's happening as far as the development of the language. They have a whole blog type thing going on that. So
if you don't follow up with that and you just keep coding the way you always have, in 10 years, are you just out of
what happens is you'll go to a new web host and they'll be using PHP 5 and you've been using PHP 4 this whole time on your server, and so you're going to just dump your code into the PHP 5 environment and some of the shit's not going to work, and you're like, wait,
not so good.
Or it's going to say this is depreciated and don't use it again, or deprecated,
really?
Whatever.
Deprecated.
I get those mixed up a lot.
You have to stay up with it then?
Well, it's in your interest, and I guess it's a coincidence that when I would go to look up stuff about PHP, I'd use this website, and it's good though, because you can stay up to date that way. And there's pros and cons to using the latest language release, because some servers aren't running that stuff, so you kind of have to be in the middle with the language. It's strange to describe it like this, but if you're using the most cutting edge, you know, PHP features, you might have trouble finding servers or hosts out there that are running the newest version of PHP unless you have a dedicated machine. I had this specific problem happen to me. And if you're using old enough code or old enough language features, constructs, whatever you want to call them, then you will have that same problem. You will go to run your code on, you know, a newer server. They'll update the server, and your site just epic fails, goes
usually
down.
Usually it's kind of like extraneous things, like just printing and just all the basic stuff, like opening files and stuff like that. That's pretty basic. But when you get more into the MySQL stuff or doing advanced sorting and things like that, then the features start to change. I'm actually at PHPNet right now, and PHP 5.3.6 was just released on the 17th of March, so it's, you know, a couple months ago. But the bug fixes they have here, Sam, the numbers of the bugs, it looks like they're all sequential. Like, you know, they started at bug 1 and just kept fixing. And they're at bug 54,247.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Which is not to say the language is the buggiest in the world. It's just like...
It's a benefit, though, that it's open source as compared to a Microsoft language.
It's a living, you know, breathing, evolving language. And, you know, I think it's awesome. I'm a fan. Not that I've, you know, I first learned to program in C++. And at the time, I was young enough where I was like, I don't know, programming seems weird to me. And then recently, when I got back into it, I learned PHP. And I'm like, ooh, yeah, this is awesome. I like it. And, you know, there's a topic for another time. It'd be good to touch on the differences between them, like as far as a strictly typed language versus a loosely typed language.
Right, we can talk about that. That's a good thing to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to hit it now, but that's just something. It's interesting to talk, you know, to learn about that, those differences. So if you are at least curious about programming, you know maybe what you want to try and then what you can learn on and maybe what you want to work towards.
I think we talk about that. A lot of people kind of don't know much about programming, or they're scared about it, or things like that. So that's good.
It can be daunting, you know,
it's
to think
very
about
daunting,
it.
Yeah.
It's portrayed as, you know, a guy in a basement behind a monitor, like, you know, looking like Gollum and hacking away at a blank keyboard with a bunch of monitors all around him. Never see the light of day. Well, maybe not really. That's just, I get carried away with my imagination sometimes. But,
fair enough.
No, it's a big topic, and I like the idea of mastering PHP. I'm not there yet. I'm arbitrarily probably like a 6 out of 10 on the PHP scale, the master scale. So I want to master that before I move on to whatever's next.
Very nice.
All right. So you mentioned, you know, being in the middle of releases, and that sort of reminded me of the Internet Explorer releases. I mean, IE6 was used a completely different standard, as I understand it, than what Firefox had at the time. And what was it? Opera was really the Opera browser.
Opera, yeah.
Opera.
I mean, how the hell do you pronounce that thing?
Opera.
I think Opera, it's Opera. Browser.
And it is and Opera.
Netscape, yeah. too. And was Firefox so, even... out no. at IE6? Yeah, it was...
Yeah.
Yeah?
Maybe in the early days,
IE5
I don't remember.
IE5 came out. I remember the release date was crazy. There was, like, robots, and I don't know, there was all kinds of stuff going on the release date.
What?
I remember, like, giant statues over... I didn't ever see them, but, like, in Palo Alto, they had, like giant release day parade and shit like that. It was, like, crazy. And then millions of downloads.
And so...
Millions.
You know, and then IE7 came along. I forget which one. Is it IE7 that started with the compatibility mode? Or is that IE8?
One of those.
That's 8.
Okay, well, it started with the compatibility modes, and now you've got this, like, screwed up thing where it might work or maybe not because Microsoft decided to change their mind and stop being evil with the messing with the standards thing. So
yeah, no, without getting too deep into it, this is another good topic to touch on, too, is the evolution of the browsers and, you know, the different retarded things that happened because of that. So that... For, you know, for another show, that'd be a good thing to cover. And, you know, like Stephen Hawking's book, A Short History of the Universe, or whatever it's called. we could do that as a topic one time. A Short History of Internet Browsers.
That's funny.
But just basically that fact alone, one of the attorneys I work with uses Westlaw. And they have a really nifty feature where you can highlight some text, right-click, and it brings up this really cool little context menu where you can tell it, like, highlight and copy and, you know, just simple things like that that you could do manually, I guess. But having the highlight feature built into, like, the I don't know if it's AJAX. I don't know exactly how it works. But basically, bottom line is it doesn't work in IE anymore. It used to work in IE6, and now it doesn't. And so I'm like, okay, let's try compatibility mode. And she's sort of just, like, watching me, like, fumble around with this thing, like, doing all the updates, checking compatibility mode. And I'm like, nope, still doesn't work. And I'm like, okay, we're going to do Chrome. Let's do Chrome, load the thing up, and of course, everything works perfectly fine. And she's like, well, why doesn't it work? Why can't I just have it the old way it used to work in IE6? And I'm like, you know, I just can't let you use IE6
yeah.
without giving you, I don't even know what kind of security
I
would need to, like,
unplug the internet.
Yeah, yeah, but you can use it offline.
And then, oh, wait, you need to connect to the Westlaw.
Yeah, so she really wanted to know why. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to tell you why Microsoft.
You should have just said
this.
Immediately when she asked that. You should have, well, how much time do you have?
Yeah, like I say, like this, everything about these types of stuff has a really big history to it, you know? And here's why.
It's ridiculous.
Here's why. And I said, and here's why I can't let you use IE6. You know,
that's good. That's good. I like it. No, we should definitely do that in a future show. A short history of the internet browser.
Okay.
I like it.
We'll do a short history of the universe. No problem.
Very nice. Something we were talking about last show was kind of got distracted, I guess, on OBD2, which is the technology that allows you to read information back from your car. Everything mm-hmm. after 97, right, Merrick, or 96?
Yes, 96 and up is OBD2.
And one of the things Sam were talking about was having your VIN number actually stored in there, and Sam was like, well, couldn't you just modify it, or how would you change it?
Right.
And I wanted to talk about different kinds of read-only memory, specifically fuse-burning chips. That is where you have like a chip with an array of wires, and if you apply too much voltage at the crossing point, you can burn a little fuse, and then you can read back to see if there's electricity flowing through there or not. It's pretty cool because this design is used sometimes with digital watches. Basically, a chip maker will say, we're going to make a digital watch, and they will make a die that has a bunch of different options for this digital watch. Like it has a stop, timer, and whatever, all this crap. And then they sell this chip to individual watch manufacturers, and the way they configure it is that they burn out these little fuses. So basically, when you buy the chip, it has all the options possible, and you basically program, it's either like a little program or like basically specific wirings, and you burn it out, and that once it's burned in, you can't change it. That's what it is, and then they sell it as a watch. It's a pretty cool way of developing and changing chips. Is that fascinating to you, Sam?
Very much so. I think that whole idea is really clever. I was really, really surprised to hear about burning in like the VIN number when you first mentioned it. I never even occurred to me that that was possible in that sort of physical regard. I mean, I imagined it being able to be read-only, you know, in some kind of mechanism. But not that hardcore. That's really read-only.
Well, yeah,
really
no, it is. It's just hardware read-only is all that is, I guess, huh?
But it's like really read-only.
Really, really, really.
Yeah.
Sometimes those are called ASIC, which stands for Application-Specific Integrated Circuit. Another thing that you can do with this whole fuse burning thing, I guess actually you step back a little bit. There's these chips called FPGA, which stands for Field Programmable Gate Array. And let's say this chip has, I don't know, like 16 wires on the outside. A couple of those wires are going to be like a serial in and serial out, and you can put a little program on this guy which will allow you to connect those wires. So you could say if wires 1 and 2 are high, I want wire 3 to be high. And if they're not, if both of those wires aren't high, then I want it to be low. Basically, like you're making a little AND gate inside this chip. And you can just program software down, and it's just like a, it's like EEPROM, where you can erase it, like you were saying, Sam.
Right.
But once you've designed your FPGA, you've got your program working properly, you can switch over to an ASIC and burn it in for good. So you've got the same program, you've written your chip, you've designed like whatever you're trying to make, and then when you want to make 100,000 of them, you go with a much cheaper option of burning them in. Or you can even actually design a chip that doesn't have any options. It just comes out of the factory and it only does one thing.
So an FPGA would be good for prototyping or, you know, multiple lab environments, and then when you're ready to go to production, you'd spec it out to China or wherever.
Exactly. And this is for, like, big things. Like, this is, like, making, you know, this is, like, millions of dollars because you want to make 100,000, cut a new die, all these things. But another cool thing about FPGAs is that sometimes people will use them in routers. Like, if you've got those big enterprise routers that have maybe 8 network ports and things like that, you want to have hardware in between. You don't want to have software, so you don't want to have a CPU. It's kind of like the thing between a graphics card and a CPU. The FPGA is kind of like the graphics card where everything's coming in parallel. So you can write your software on your router, and it's really quick, but you can still do firmware upgrades. And the firmware upgrades actually changes the physical properties of how the chip behaves.
So cool.
It's pretty cool. It's another good use of FPGAs. Also, satellites use them a lot. Because you can reconfigure everything, you know, that's going on.
From the ground.
From the ground, right.
Go to space and flip a dip switch.
if you were, you know, programming some camera and you fucked up so hard, you're like, oh, we should have really been holding this line low. We should be holding chip select low, not high, during this 5-millisecond period. Like, doing that in software, like, maybe you wouldn't be able to change it. Or maybe, you want it to have 7 volts, not 5 volts. You can't just go in software and be like, I'd like to increase the voltage on this physical property, please.
That's interesting. So FPGAs are cool. I like them.
Yeah. One final really quick note about them being interchangeable. At my work, we were using a kind of programmable memory for PLAs, which is basically like a weak FPGA, same thing basically, and the chip went obsolete, so we were no longer able to reprogram these. Now, in our case, we didn't reprogram them a lot, or basically at all. Once we sold them, they were as they were, but the only replacement we could find was the burn-in fuse kind. So we were actually able to take something that used to be erasable and now replace it with a burn-in fuse. And we got a new programmer because it has to be able to do the burning and stuff like that. And then we can still sell our same boards. You know, it has different current requirements, but that's basically the only difference. So it's pretty interesting how these different technologies can just drop in and replace each other.
It's really clever. Ben.
Sam.
Ad hoc Wi-Fi.
Well, this is probably our last topic for the day, but I wanted to talk a little bit about ad hoc Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi can operate in two different modes. Most consumers will only know it in infrastructure mode. What that means is that you buy a router, which is the infrastructure, and it kind of serves out DHCP for everyone on the network. Also, all the packets have to go back to that base station. So, like, Sam, if you and I were in the same room with our laptops, right? And we were sending a file between our two laptops, the packets would actually have to go out into the living room, out to the router, and then come back. So my packet would go to the router and then back to your laptop. But there's another way you can configure them, which is in ad hoc mode, where all the devices kind of join on a net. It's really cool because, like, if you have, let's say you had a really long house with, like, 5 rooms and they were all in a row, if your mm-hmm. router or if your internet source couldn't make it down the whole way, if you switch it over to ad hoc, because the nodes talk directly to each other, they actually would forward the traffic. So right. if your house was really long, just because the person in the fifth room can't hear the router, they can hear the person in the fourth room, and that's all they need.
But let's say the fourth person goes to bed and turns their computer off, then would it auto-connect to the third?
It should. If it can hear the third person, that's the whole point, is that the network should rearrange. Now, you and I tried this, and we tried it with two iPods and then a laptop.
Right.
And we weren't really sure what was going on. I guess there was too many factors.
Yeah, there's too many variables. Like, it could have been, I remember it could have been connecting to the base station or not.
Right, to the laptop or to not. It was very, very complicated.
We would need it to be more locked down, I think.
We need a more controlled kind of scientific result. But one cool thing that I did was I was developing my my application for my iPod, which hopefully I'm going to ship soon. I'm excited. There's a lot of work going into that right now. But for my application, I need to be able to connect my iPod to my laptop and talk specifically to a Windows machine on my laptop. And so I was out driving around, and I found like a nice shady spot in my car, and I just busted out all my devices. And I looked around the neighborhood, and there weren't any open network. So basically, I didn't have any internet, totally disconnected. And so I was going to develop my application, so I pulled up my iPod Touch, and I was like, okay, now I need to, start programming. And I was like, but I can't. My iPod Touch only works on Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. And if there's no access point, then how is my laptop going to talk to my iPod?
Right.
Like, I couldn't figure that out. And then I was like, oh, ad hoc. So if you go on Macintosh and you click on the little thing, you say create network on your little Wi-Fi icon. And then says create a computer-to-computer network. So I created one, and I connected with my iPod, and it worked fine. And there was the IP address was like 169.150.something.something.
That's the auto-configure IP.
Right, but right? It was .x.x.x. It wasn't normally when you have a network at home, only the last digit varies. So basically, home routers can only support 254 people on the network. But with this, it was 255 times 255 times 255, all under the 169 network. So you can do the math there, but that's a lot more computers.
Well, right, but what I'm saying is that, like, whenever your computer by default is unable to connect to...
It goes exactly into that one. It's the auto-configure network. Right. More it's like the I'm lost configuration.
169.254.255.254 is that whole range that's
exactly
reserved for that purpose.
Exactly.
So yours was that, basically?
Mine was that, but the three numbers in the third spot weren't all the same mm-hmm. at all. They were all different. And okay. So I was kind of worried that I was worried about how normally on a home network, I'm only able to get to computers that are on my same, it's a Class C subnet, right? But since I was on a Class B, I guess, or Class A, maybe, I was able to, my packets were able to communicate between the devices. So I actually had two iPods and my MacBook all on this ad hoc network, and it worked fine. I mean, they were all in my lap, right, because I was doing app development, but I bet you I could have gotten pretty far with it.
All right.
That's pretty cool. So if you need to ever set up a standalone network for yourself, it worked out pretty easy for you.
And the last cool part was that my Windows machine that I'm connecting to is actually a VM. And so I put the VM into bridged mode. So I actually had four computers on my little ad hoc network, even though the MacBook and the XP VM were on the same hardware. They had different IPs.
Nice.
That's clever. Give yourself an
And it worked great. I sat there for an hour and a half and like got some features done, so I was really happy.
Cool, cool.
Nice work, Ben. Do we have anything else to discuss in this episode?
I think that's it for this week, guys.
Yeah, we covered a lot. Even stuff we didn't mean to. The keyboard session was fun. I like that.
How many keyboards can we get?
How many keyboards did we talk about? I don't even know.
That was quite a few.
I had another keyboard I even held myself back from talking about, so maybe we'll talk about that next week.
There's always time next week.
Alright. So great. Next episode will be number 10. Thanks for joining us. Ben?
Yeah, great. Thanks for joining us. Please send us feedback to packets@portforwardpodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you guys. And check out our website at www.portforwardpodcast.com. And don't forget to subscribe to our RSS feed. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Have a good night.
Bye. dude, I'm in your server. Yes. Hey, is your server VM?
Yeah, it's
on
a VM
server.
Yeah.
Oh, you're so fucking cool. Love that shit, dude. It's just it's already up. Ben doesn't even need to worry about it.
No, you want to know my uptime, dude? Let me connect real quick.
I'd love to know. For Zen server or for...
Well, I'll give you the breakdown here, okay? So uptime for Zen server is 37 days.
All right. Okay, you have to update that thing? Or?
No, never. Well, barely.
So you should never...
Once every 6 months. Exactly. Yeah. And I've got two VMs with 37 days uptime. Mm-hmm. One with 30 days. 5 days, 4 days, 1 day.
Dude, I want to get a blank keyboard. I was so excited about it when I was reading about keyboards, and then like I probably forgot about it until you mentioned it again.
All right, dude, the URL is has Sony been hacked this week?
Fucking long. Yes. Oh god. This is gonna go down in history as the power of pissing off the underground internet. It's like, seriously, like Sony was like, oh, we're Sony, we're big and cool, and no, you can't hack our PS3, and then fucking GeoHot's like, what, bitches? And Sony's like, we're huge and we're gonna slap you, and then they've been slapped, and it's so crazy. I already changed the I forgot we're not recording. Oh yeah, we are. That's crazy. Oh man, that's so funny. I just installed that and forgot it was recording.
No, not that. I'm amused that you copied and pasted my rant. I forgot that I wrote all that. I'm like reading this, I'm like, wow, this sounds like something I would bitch about.
Oh wait, it is.
And I'm like, oh my god, my rant from like last week. That's so funny.
You should keep ranting, and you could maybe one day rise to the rant level of Gordon Ma Ong.
Gordon Ma Ong rant of the week, dude.
But there was no actual internet involved?
No, dude.
What the fuck were you doing?
I was testing out my network protocol, dude. How was he supposed to do network programming?
It's really funny, though. You're like, oh, I'm going to pretend that there's internet. I love that.
And it's... You know, without me doing that much looking, like, from what I know about podcasts, it's... Ours is kind of cool so far. I already talked to you about this before, but, like, when I was searching for one about programming, like, I couldn't really find anything, and the one I found was, like, pretty crappy, and the dude only did 3 episodes, like, 10 years ago, and I was like, oh, that's cool. But, yeah, so I think it could become a thing.